Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and I am very happy to do this show because over the years I've investigated what it is to live into new realities, how we are collectively changing the nature of reality, what we think is true and real, and we are actually feel like we're evolving into a new understanding of who we are. And that is why I was very drawn to tonight's speaker, Glenn Aparicio Parry. He's written a book called Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. Glenn is a writer, educator, international speaker, entrepreneur, and visionary whose lifelong passion is to reform thinking and education into a coherent, cohesive whole. He's the founder and president of SEED Institute, and he's also the president of the think tank, the Circle of Original Thinking, and we can go on and on. But Glenn, welcome to the program, and what I really liked, just about the book itself, is this idea that that thinking is original. And I know you start out the book with thinking is thanking. And can you get into that piece a little bit, what you mean by that?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah. I'd love to. The origin of thinking is thanking. I mean, etymologically, in English and in about six related languages that I can think of.
You mean they're the same word, basically?
Thinking and thanking come from the Proto-Germanic root, pankas. I mean, it's also related to an early root, a Proto-Germanic tang, which means to think and feel. So, what it really means, perhaps, certainly my interpretation, is that the origin of thinking is a much fuller, much wider, and much more, it's a field of infinite gratitude. It almost means to me that originally all our thoughts were prayers, and they were prayers that came from a place of blessing. So, in antiquity, we felt blessed, loved, and embraced by Mother Earth. We were not just living on the Earth. We were embedded in and of the Earth. We were in tune with the rhythms of the sun and the moon, the rain and the snow, the migration of animals, the return of berries, seeds, and nuts. All these things were so integral to our worldview that our first thoughts, our first inspirations were just all about connection, all about blessing, all about gratitude. And that's a good thing to remember.
No, that's a great thing. And of course, I think thinking has gotten very far from that, because what you've just described, in a sense, is not what I call thinking. Because thinking seems, right, to be the separation, the removal of us from thanking and nature and all the holistic things. So something's happened in that.
Well, that's very, very true. What we've done is we've pigeonholed thought, and now only the mental, rational aspect of cognition do we even call thought anymore.
And thinking, thinking, because what you just described, what I would say is more feeling. That's not thinking, that's feeling.
One of my purposes in writing the book is to broaden the definition of thought so that we understand that, the way thought emerges. That's why the book is intentionally named Original Thinking. It's partly playfully named that, too, which I could explain in a minute, but the origin of thought is this continuum. It comes from nature. It kind of bubbles up from the ground. You might feel it in the feet of your souls. You might have a gut instinct. It might unfold into a heart knowing, and then later on, if you stick with it, it can become an intellectual understanding that's really grounded in the natural world. But what we are doing, as you correctly said, we're tending to jump too quick to rational thought, And we've demoted everything else. We've cast it out. It's no longer thought. It's just instinct, feeling, emotion, intuition. But this is not the way the ancients thought at all. In fact, a word like intuition, which today, if you look it up in the dictionary, means direct perception apart from reasoning, originally it meant a sacred contemplation. It was another aspect of thought.
That's what intuition meant. So you're broadening the definition of thought and thinking to include this whole sense of what it is to be human, in a sense, right?
I mean, that's very much true. Yes. I mean, the origin of the book, if I may, came about through dialogues, which I was blessed to participate and organize, that brought together Native American elders and Western scientists, primarily quantum physicists at the origin. And those actually began before I was involved. They began in 1992, exactly 500 years after Columbus came to the continent. Leroy Little Bear approached David Bohm. Bohm, turned out, was in the last year of his life, but he participated in the first dialogue. And there was David Bohm, the junior colleague of Einstein, of course, and David Peet, another
physicist. I met David Peet. I like him. He's a good
David
guy.
Peet's a physicist and a great writer who wrote Blackfoot Physics because he's coming out of these dialogue experiences. But anyway, in that very first dialogue that I organized for the Seed Institute, Leroy Little Bear's first question was a very simple one, or seemingly simple one. He just said, is it possible to come up with an original thought? And a very interesting thing happened, Alan, when he asked that question. All the indigenous people in the room took the question completely differently than the Western people. The Western people in the room, with one exception that I recall, tried to think of something brand new, something that had never been said before or done before.
That's what I thought you meant.
Well, that's what it's the words come to mean, but the indigenous people went to the root of the word original, which of course is origin from place, and they took the question completely differently as an invitation to connect with that ever-present regenerative field, or even original instructions, which is a native phrase if your listeners are familiar with, original instructions for how to live on the planet. Those are the instructions that have been given by Creator. And it's all about living well, which is quite different than the way we think of the word original today, where we think of it innovative and novel and whatnot. So in very brief, what I'm searching for is a unitive consciousness between time and place. That's part of it, anyway, because we need to heal and reconnect with place. We need to remember, in the original sense of the word, which means to become whole again, remember. And for those men in your audience, you don't want to know the original meaning of being dismembered is a very unpleasant one, but
it's not being remembered, is it?
What?
It's losing that memory.
Losing that member, actually. But to remember how to think as nature thinks, to me that's the most important thing that we could ever do, because we've moved in the opposite direction, as you've, I'm sure, observed. We've tried to become almost nature in ourselves. We've made ourselves into a kind of a demigod. And that's when we began to imagine that only human beings were thinking. We also began to imagine that only human beings have language. And all of that created a separation between ourselves and the natural world.
Well,
and that's the problem.
No, it's very timely we're having this conversation, because I'm off in a few weeks to Australia to work with the Australian Aborigines, and and they are one of the peoples that have kept that tradition intact, and they call their time the voices of the first day. That's their their lineage goes back to the first day, and you know,
right.
we're here
right.
to live at that time, and they
right.
and they have that indigenous wisdom where I think they very much have never forgotten the original thought. I mean, that's what little I know about them. Yeah,
I would say so. I mean, I wonder if that's the correct translation, if you say the first day, because
my guess
would be that the Aborigine people wouldn't really begin think of a first day as in the way Western people tend to, because they probably understand the cosmos as always here.
I think that's what they mean. This is the first day, you know.
Yeah.
We are, you know, it's not there was. It's not a time thing.
I know, but it is for the West. See, so we've replaced place with time. Mm. That's why it doesn't really matter whether we're a fundamentalist Judeo-Christian or a scientist. It's just a matter of time. The scientist might say 14 billion years, the fundamentalist might say 6,000 years, but they both share the belief or the addiction, I would say, in a beginning.
Well, I think that's a really great place to frame your whole approach. I also like what you say here is that we've remade land into real estate, the rhythms of the earth into time, and time into money. And we've created these false gods that in a sense don't mean anything to who we truly are as living organic beings. You know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we tend to make, as in your words, false gods of abstract concepts.
Right.
Like one of the dialogues we experienced, another question that Leroy Littlebear asked was, is it possible, he asked, do you really and truly believe in a separation of church and state? And that was asked during the Bush administration, by the way. It was, which is somewhat relevant. But when we got deeply into the question, we found out for indigenous people, those are just two abstract concepts. They don't believe in either, you know, church and state. What they would believe in fact, it was an Australian Aborigine who said this, they would believe in land and country, you know, in a spirit and country, you know, these are real, but abstract concepts are things that we just play with our minds, but we get very stuck on them.
We'll
fight wars over them.
You are looking at a whole revisioning of who we are and the way we relate to, well, ourselves, but also the world, and in this strange culture we've created. I mean, that's a huge undertaking, you know, what you're attempting to restructure here. I mean...
Well, thank you, I guess.
I mean, it needs it, but it's big.
I'm ambitious, I suppose. I didn't write a huge book either. It's, you know, 275 pages. It's very readable. It's very accessible. It's. I'm not trying to write a gigantic a magnum opus or a theory. I'm just trying to share a balance of rational mind and also come from my heart and intuition. Because it's all connected, and that's really what I wanted to convey. One of the nicest things somebody said, Victoria Hanshin, said about in reading the book, she said that she felt like she was being rocked back and forth in the cradle between left and right brain. I said, well, thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to do.
So get into this whole thing about space or place and time and the kind of fabrications and overlays of ideas and ideology that we put on top of those simple aspects of being. We've we've abstracted ourselves and we've lost our connection to both time and space and place and ourselves.
Yeah. Thanks for asking that. I did, one of the key things that I focused on, which I usually don't write about in a short piece because it's a little bit harder to explain in a short piece, was what happened during the Renaissance, which is not actually, it's really what was building from maybe the advent of Christianity when there was a little bit more emphasis on the future as being beyond this world or something. But it wasn't really until the Renaissance that we shifted. It actually happened during Leonardo da Vinci's lifetime. In the beginning of da Vinci's lifetime, it was believed that if you look toward nature, that the nature's emanated spirit back to you. Mm. By the end of da Vinci's lifetime, linear perspective had taken place in art and had been adopted. And, you know, we can pinpoint when that happened. I think it was 1514, Brunelleschi. He looks into a mirror and he paints what he sees in the mirror out of the best of intentions. He wanted to paint as God saw. He wanted to show this beautiful depiction. Very good intention. And then later on, another fellow came along and actually formulated that into a book, a set of instructions for how to do linear perspective. And then it became adopted. And when it was adopted, there was a major, major shift that most people don't ever think about. And it was really the first time that, at least in the West, that we began to believe as real that the future was ahead of us.
Because up until that time, what did we believe?
Well, the ancient Greeks, for instance, believed that the future was behind them. Because, think about it for just a moment, because it actually makes a lot of sense. Now, the future is something you can't see, right? Mm-hmm. If you believe that you can't see the future, then it's behind you. And what was in front of you was the past, because it had already manifested, mm-hmm. and so therefore you can see it. For the ancient Greeks, it was an act of hubris if you believe that you could control or predict the future. So, of course, they would go to an oracle if they wanted to get some insight into the future. But for human beings to try to control it was hubris, was an act of arrogance. But once we start to believe that the future is ahead of us, that shifts our original, and I use that intentionally, our original participation in the unfolding of the cosmos, and all of a sudden the power comes to our eye. And if you see those depictions of linear perspective, you always see a single eye, a single fixed eye, and emanating away from the eye are the lines that represent the future. That's really the beginning of our addiction to linear time, and it's only a little over 500 years ago that this happened. Before then, we were really still way more apt to believe in time as unfolding in a circle, which is also what Aristotle and Plato taught. After that, we began to see time as unfolding in a line, because that's the way it is in linear perspective. The things in linear perspective that are closer to you are supposed to happen sooner. The things that are further away from you in your line of vision are supposed to be off in the future. So, I mean, that's... And
what
also
did the natives...
Are you understanding what I'm saying?
I think I am, but I'm just curious what the natives thought the future, or the native, that the indigenous wisdom, where do they think the future is?
Well, go when you're going to Australia, ask the Maori, and you'll find out that they today are more apt to think of the future as behind them. Ask them.
I will. And the Native Americans?
It's...
I'm just saying, the
difficult thing is that Native people or indigenous people in general don't really believe in linear time, and even the ancient Greeks, it wasn't really just that there was a line coming from behind them or in front of them to behind them. It was more that the future was enveloping you in all directions. Remember Carlos Castaneda?
I love Castaneda.
Well, Carlos Castaneda spoke about death stalking you from behind. Mm-hmm. Well, is your death in the future or the past?
Well, I don't know.
By the way, I was just in a lecture with Dr. Vasant Lad, the renowned Ayurvedic physician,
I know him. He's great. He's in Albuquerque near you, right?
He's in Albuquerque because I was doing Panchakarma, so I sat in on his class with his students. And one of his students, who meant really well, of course, meant something else, but actually asked the question, is it possible to be born in the past? And, of course, Vasant Lad said, of course, that's why you're here.
Mm.
but I think the student meant to be reborn in the past. But still, you understand what I'm saying.
No, I do. And I think maybe it is possible because time is circular. And, you know, the physicists who seem to be returning, in a sense, the modern quantum physics to original thinking because they sort of found that that is the way of nature. Well, they're saying all time is circular anyway and not linear. And somehow we are, this whole idea of time being linear has gotten us away from our origins. And we think we're in this like ongoing sort of almost doomsday ride over a cliff, you know, that doesn't have any meaning. We've lost the meaning because of this, I think, linear focus that doesn't return to anything.
Well, you're very right. I mean, I personally, I believe in my heart and soul what I'm talking about. So I have abandoned certain phrases in our language. For instance, I don't say Happy New Year anymore. Why'd you say Happy Renew Year? Because that's what it is. It's not like we haven't been here before. You know, every January it's cold and the sun is coming up from certain
age. Yeah, but are we going somewhere? Is there evolution? You're saying?
Well, yes, I don't not believe in evolution, but I do believe in something more spiral progressive and one that circles within circles within circles and eventually unfolds into a little bit different place than where you were. So it's not that things repeat. And one of the biggest misconceptions often said about indigenous cultures is to dismiss them as being static when nothing could be further from the truth because they're very plugged into the ecosystemic changes that are happening on the earth. So they're the ones that are really, really, and certainly in an intact culture, are really very conscious of what is changing. Mm. And it's the Western people, often, who are so much believing in a linear progressive future, who are not noticing at all what's going on, because we're in our abstract mind.
We've created this abstract mind to take the place of what it is to really be alive. In that sense, would you say?
Well, a little bit. I mean, it's
we've lost our connection to nature.
And we've become proud of it. That's what's disturbing to me is that, you know, we began. See, once we adopted this idea of that our brain or our mind or our eye was looking out on something separate from us and calling it the world, we divorced ourselves from the original meaning of consciousness, which is knowing with. That's where the con comes from, with. So just like, it's something that we still have it in our language, though. For instance, Alan, you still say the phrase, right, a thought came to me, right?
I probably do say that, yes.
And you know why?
Because it...
It really did.
It really does come from somewhere. No, I believe that. I think we are receivers of thought and not necessarily generators of thought.
Well,
I mean,
that's a very interesting question. I think we're both, but we're much more of a transformer than an originator. In other words, I mean, a thought comes from somewhere. We can send it on with good intent, and that I would call a prayer. And we could send it on with ill intent, and that would be a form of a curse. And we could change it and modify it in certain kinds of ways based on our own physical vehicle. But we don't create it out of nothing. It's far more real to understand that the thought waves are coming from society and from nature. I compare thinking with water, Alan, because we are 70% water, and I believe we think as water thinks, and I do think water thinks, and water is alive, and it's very disturbing to me when mainstream society considers water as dead, because, you know, what makes the water dead that's outside of our body, even though we're made of 70% water, so we certainly think the water inside our body is alive, don't we? But somehow,
Do you think all what we call inanimate objects or things are alive, like rocks and, you know, whatever? Yeah.
Well, look, ultimately it doesn't really matter. Those words about life, of what's alive or inanimate, those are very heavy-laden labels. I'll say this. I believe that everything... I tend to say that everything is alive, but if you want to make distinctions between what you call animate and inanimate, let's just say that everything is capable of becoming animate at any moment, and everything contains animacy within it. I personally believe that spirit is, you know, pervades everything.
I really like the way you're thinking and talking and expressing. And was this a revelation for you? I mean, well, you brought up sort of pretty Western, like everyone else, thinking, you know, water is dead and thinking is intellect. I mean, was there a moment where, like, the light went off for you and said, wait a minute?
I suppose there was. I mean, I was brought up by two parents that were fairly secular. My father was an engineer. My mother was Jewish, but she didn't practice until her father died. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they were both had a scientific worldview, I would say, but they were both very moral ethicists and good people. But my father happened to study world religion, and he taught a class to me when I was 11 years old on all the world's religions. So I had a real great blessing there. So I was learning about Judaism and Shinto and Jainism and Zoroastrianism and, you know, every kind of religion there was, except perhaps Native American beliefs. And he taught in a great way. We would go to the houses of worship, and I remember still today going to those places because it made a very big impression. It's much better than learning in an abstract way only. So we actually...
Sounds great. Mm.
It was great, you know, and it was part of a great blessing to be open-minded. And so I was not raised... Whatever a person is raised is... a blessing, I believe. I mean, if I were raised in a completely one-dimensional way, I might have been able to have gotten very deep into that dimension, and that could have been an impetus for becoming something very different later on. So it's not that any one way is right or anything. But as for the light going on, it went on through... I lived in Asia. I met and married a Japanese woman. That took me to a very different worldview, and I didn't realize it, but while I was living in Japan for close to 4 years, I was actually preparing to to work closely with Native Americans when I came back, because there were a lot of similarities between Asian culture and indigenous cultures in ways that I didn't realize while I was in Asia.
Mm. So, but this way of thinking, the idea of original thought, and what you want to bring out to the world through this book, was that something that, when did you get that? Like, when did you realize all this?
When did I realize I wanted to write the book?
No, when did you realize that it was this original thought, as you're calling it, that was not what we call thinking, that there's this gift to being and consciousness and thanking? Yeah, when did that come to you, the whole idea of this original thought?
I'm really not sure, but I do remember once having a meeting where I was with some people from Utney Reader or something, and I just casually mentioned to them that their thoughts are not their thoughts, that what you think is your thought really is something that we're sharing in a field of consciousness, and getting a real blank stare back. But, you know, these days that happens far less frequently. People are far more open to that. I see people quoting Rumi constantly about, you know, there's a field that we're going to meet in. You know, there's so many books, you know, that have now come out because consciousness is shifting and we're beginning to pull out of this materialistic age. And it's really, you know, it's been going on for couple hundred years, and it's been, and among some people it never left. You know, I mean, there were always people who were rebelling against the trend. You know, they were just, you know, and later on we called them romanticists and transcendentalists. We always have some weird name for that because, I mean, the transcendental label is one of the strangest ones because Emerson and Thoreau, they were not transcending in the sense of, especially Thoreau was very much in the sensual physical world.
Right, I agree with you, but there was something, in a way, transcendent about their awareness that, you know, they were open to these higher ideals that were beyond the materiality that the world was creating or trying to force down people.
Yes, I'm a great fan of Emerson and Thoreau. I've read Emerson more closely, I'd say, but I just, they're speakers. There's wisdom speaking through them. They had contact with indigenous peoples, by the way, lots of it. That doesn't get mentioned much. And they had contact with Asian peoples. You know, they were not stuck in their own cultural milieu, so they were speaking from a larger platform, if you want to call it that.
No, it's good. So I'm writing a lot about creativity. I interviewed Michael Gelb. He's out there somewhere, isn't he? About creativity. He's in New Mexico. But this idea of original thought and creativity or thinking to me is a very creative act. Or that's what originally I thought that's what you meant by the book. This had to have this original thought, like you said, which is, how do we bring in new thought? How do we have a new thought?
People tend to jump to. And it actually is partly about that. You know, it's not that I'm against novelty. In fact, I'm for a fresh, original thought, which is not a thought that's been chewed over and mulled over like a cow, you know, chewing her cud, because that's what we tend to think. That's why we've become to believe that our thoughts are our thoughts, you know, because we're addicted to them so much that they're hovering around us. They're like our friends.
Right. They're our best friends.
They are our best friends. Our beliefs are, you know, and you've seen, I'm sure you're doing a very creative radio show, so you've met a lot of very interesting people, and you know that when people are confused by something, they'll sometimes cling to their old beliefs, but you've probably been able to observe that.
No, I have. But the other thing, excuse me, the idea that you said about the West and linear thinking, the idea is there is this ongoing stream of creativity and new ideas that is leading this culture into this linear time. So, I mean, so where does this whole sense of creative thinking come into the idea of original thinking? I guess that's really one.
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you. I mean, well, creativity and originality are words that are often used interchangeably.
Exactly, yes.
And I think that actually, I like them both. I mean, the word original is very full of meaning because it bridges the old and new, because it does mean both place and progression of time. But creativity, in a very similar way, I think of thought as tantamount to spirit. It's something that comes from Creator. It's something that moves through us. So thought itself is very creative, potentially. The problem with the modern definition of creativity, as my friend Alfonso Montori over at the California Institute of Integral Studies would say, is that we're addicted to this concept of the myth of the lone genius. We think that Einstein is creative, but, you know...
His
secretary isn't, or something. You know, we think that only certain people are creative, and the whole problem is that these words have become stuck nouns when they really are verbs. They're forces that are moving through. But because when our culture, you know, remember I was talking about linear perspective before. Mm-hmm. Part of the result of linear perspective, part of the result of the way that we've come to see the world, is we've become addicted to nouns and we've become addicted to labeling things. And what that does is it stops the world. It stops the creative force. So now we call so-and-so is a genius instead of like the Greeks. I mean, genius was a verb. It was moving through you, you know, and that's really what it is. So, you know, what I'm asking for is for people to remember how thought really happens and to experience it as this continuum, this very, very creative force that welling within them, and to watch it really carefully and to allow it to unfold on its own time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were talking about Emerson before. One of the most beautiful things he ever spoke about was instinct, and he spoke about how important instinct was. That's another word that I would like to reclaim for its beautiful meaning, because instinct connects us with the environment. It connects us. It has nothing to do with annihilating or being lower than intelligence. It's the beginning of intelligence. So Emerson would say that you first have an instinct, then an opinion, and then a knowledge, as the plant has root, bud, and fruit. Trust your instinct to the end, though you can render no reason.
I think Emerson was great, and I think instinct is a very much a key to the redefinition of who we are. But I also think, I don't know if I should keep using that word, but I also think
you could
that
say thank if you want.
I also thank, now I sound like I'm from the South, I thank, but there's something to be said for linearity and progress. You know, there's the Western thought since the Renaissance forward has been on a trajectory of, making the world a better place to live for a vast majority of people that,
is the world a better place to live today?
Is the world a better place? Well, there's more people. I think it's a better place to live than it has been.
Is the water as pure as it was 100 years ago?
No, in some degrees it's not a better place.
Is the
air but there's more people, and I'm not saying it's good, living comfortably and maybe in harmony. Okay. I mean, yes, we have to clean up the water. I mean, there's a lot of problems, but there's more of us that seem to be enjoying, in my view, the world and it's okay. and the gifts okay. of this world.
Okay, let's look at that a little bit more closely.
Okay, let's
shall
look
we?
At it. Yes,
let's look at it a little bit more closely. There's the problem with the blind faith in linear progress. And that really
yes.
started to kick in during the Industrial Revolution. It wasn't the Renaissance, it was the Industrial Revolution. Because the people never would have put up with the horrible living conditions of the Industrial Revolution if they didn't already have taken within themselves the idea of the inevitability of progress. They really
but wait, let me just say there were horrible conditions of the serfdom of the Middle Ages way before the Industrial Revolution. Those people did not have pleasant lives.
I'm not sure I completely agree with you on that, but, okay. but I actually think the Middle Ages have been tremendously revised in through a modern lens to be called the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. There were a lot of very good things in the Middle Ages.
Well, there's a lot of very good things now in the Industrial Age. I think there's more food production. Anyway, go back to your
perhaps, but I just want to, you know... I admit that to some degree I'm being a devil's advocate here, but I think that there's a great danger in when you have a blind faith in linear progress, and that is the idea that the idea starts to seep into consciousness that things are always getting better day by day. It's actually the idea that really wants to be sold to us by those that are in the selling, you know, so you buy the newest computer, you buy the newest car, and what have you.
Or the newest iPhone, I have to have the newest iPhone.
The newest iPhone, you know, it's something. But what actually happens is that we become very complacent, so we don't really realize some things that may be going wrong, because we have this blind faith in the idea that things are getting better.
Well, I don't know if that. I think that's taking it. I don't think people have a blind faith in things that are getting better. They need to know there are things that need to be taken care of, but the potential is that things could get better. But what are you saying?
Well,
I'm just trying not to make it so black and white.
I will listen to anything you say. I want to have a good dialogue about it. But I believe that if people open up if they open up the New York Times. And they read something that says, a study today shows that eating 2 squares of chocolate today is better for your cardiovascular health. And 3 months ago, there was a study that said that there was no correlation between chocolate and cardiovascular health. The study of today, because it's in the newspaper today, it's news, is going to be believed more than the study 3 months ago.
Well, yes, if you believe things in the newspaper. I mean, that is, I mean, most
well,
people do.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that that's part of the risk of, and really, you know, it's very important to become aware of how these kinds of events unfold. I mean, every study that's ever undertaken is paid for by somebody and has a particular agenda in many cases. Sometimes it's sponsored by a think tank that has very clear positions one way or the other.
Yeah, or a corporation.
Or corporations.
But what are you trying to say? Because I don't tend to believe studies because it's always like now they say it's not, now they say it is. I mean... So
good. I think that's good. That's really, in my view, that shows clear-headed thinking on your part.
But I'm saying I don't think progress is all that bad. I think there are more people. If there was less greed in the world, would have the chance to have healthier, cleaner, more abundant food. I think we have the technology to feed the planet.
Healthier, cleaner, more abundant food.
That's what I think we have the potential to provide for more people. Of course, we have GMOs and we have awful chemicals.
Yes, I mean, what is the most... Look, I'm not a negative person in any regard, but I do try to look at things as clearly as I can see them. And for me, what you said about healthier, clearer, more abundant food is almost the talking points of the GMO industry. And I know you didn't mean that. But
no, I didn't mean it, because that's definitely not what GMO is. It's not healthier and it's not cleaner. It might be more abundant, but that you're feeding them poison. So I think that's not, you know, people's arguments can be distorted. But it really comes back to this idea. I'm just saying all progress is not so bad.
I'm not saying that all progress is bad. Yeah. I'm saying that try to think as nature thinks, which is an unfolding. So remember, so how does nature operate?
I don't know. Tell me, because I think that is what we need to remember, isn't it?
What's that?
That this is exactly what we need to remember as a society.
Yes.
Yes. I'm with you.
So for instance, there's a very good book, and perhaps you've interviewed her or know Janine Benyus, you know.
No. What's her book?
Biomimicry. It's a very famous book, which is talking about all the ways that we could mimic nature in designing our own systems. This is starting to have an influence on the culture, not just her book, but, you know, people are realizing, we've realized in the last 50 or so years, finally, after being extremely blind about it, we're beginning to have the concept of recycling goods. We're beginning to become aware that we can't just, there is no away, you can't throw away garbage, you know, it's going to...
I know, that's a strange concept, isn't it? Yes.
I'm not against, in fact, I'm very much for corporations or governments trying to learn from the way nature works. So let me give you an example. I mean, you know, like, Coors beer, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, that's a big corporation. They can't possibly have any good ideas, right? Well, in 1952, before they were a publicly traded corporation, Adolf Coors, who was, you know, the head of Coors at the time, made a decision to recycle all their products. You know, they started a ceramics company, which my uncle happened to work for, Coors Tech. They built some terrific ceramics. They recycled. They were the beginning people that recycled aluminum. You know, I mean, they actually did something very much in tune with nature, which I highly applaud. And I think more and more companies have to learn how to do that. And there isn't that doesn't make you less profitable. It actually ends up making you more profitable, and you do something for the planet.
No, I totally agree. This throwaway culture is destroying, you know, the world. You know, you take buy a computer, you throw it away. That those things don't bio disintegrate. I mean, they stick around, and you know, there's no way of dealing with these leftovers. I know the Native American indigenous people hardly threw anything away, or at least that's the ideal.
Everything was used. It's not necessarily the way it is in every
But everything
household.
Is used. Everything should be used and reused, and we've totally forgotten about that. And
we forgot about it a very long time ago. You know, we were the ones who, you know, were disturbed by buffalo on the side of the trains, and we shot all the buffalo just to let them lie there.
Well, you know, I mean, awful, awful things have been done in the name of progress, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we need to do now to integrate this way of thinking? And you also talk about out-of-the-box thinking. I mean, how do we evolve a new world based on this idea of original thought and returning and not necessarily throwing out all the progress? What's your ideas?
Okay. Well, one of the things that we've fixated on for being something that is progress is specialization.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in our medical profession, having, you know, a ton of specialists and whatnot.
Of course, and they don't talk to each other. It's awful.
They don't talk to each other, but they do. They do progress within their specialization. This is a very simple thing that Bucky Fuller talked a lot about. But we have to begin from holes. If we begin our thinking in wholeness, you know, and I would say also in gratitude, you know, for the world being whole, sufficient, then we can still employ abstract thought for certain purposes, but we are we're integrating an ancient way of thinking with the modern way of thinking. The modern way of thinking has an overemphasis on rational as in separate things. But the original meaning of rational, again, going back to the ancient Greeks, comes from ratio, which meant a relationship between things. So it was, for the Greeks, it was a divine proportion or the golden mean. It was very beautiful, you know. So So it's what's needed now is to integrate specialization with whole thinking. And it's not that every single person in the society needs to do it, but we need to begin to recover the original roots of things. So let's give an example. One of the things I talk about in the book a lot is economics. Because where does economics come from? Well, it should come from, it originally comes from eco, which is the Greek oikos, and it's the same root word as in ecology, you know, because economics, like when we were kids, we used to take home economics, had to do with management of the home, only the home is our whole planet. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah,
we have to reintegrate the partial view and abstracted views with their roots. Instead, we've done actually the opposite thing. One of my greatest interests in how I came into this book was education, you know, and what I had been noticing is a tremendous shift in education, which happened in just over 200 years. People don't realize it, but just over 200 years ago, there were only three subjects in academe. There was just
reading,
theology, biology, and physics. You know, and when the first universities in America started, they were run by some kind of a religious organization because of that. And later they became more secular, and that had a lot of good about it, but it also became this tremendous amoeba-like expansion of into separate, distinct fields, and it's become absurd because what Bucky Fuller used to say is we're learning more and more about less and less. We become extremely specialized, and we become extremely poor at seeing the whole. That's one of my biggest complaints.
Right, and that's what your book tries to get us back to. How do we become whole thinkers?
And it's there's so many aspects of this. And at the very end of the book, I do outline 13 aspects of what I would call original thinking. You know, thinking coming from thinking, thinking beginning in wholeness. Thinking coming from particular places or origins, and thinking being both, you know, not new or old, but both. Thinking with being in sync with the rhythms and cycles of nature. It's a lot of the stuff we've been talking about. But yes, out-of-box thinking, but also looking for the pattern that connects. That's what Gregory Bateson called for modern society to remember how to do.
Yeah, and I like Gregory Bateson. He really looked at patterns and things.
I think it's incredibly important because we're never going to solve the problems. You know, these enormous problems we have today, like climate change or food scarcity. You know, by looking at it in very partial ways.
Mm-hmm. Right, and in a sense, so talk about then. Thinking out of the box, what does that mean, and what is a thought out of the box?
Well, that's the most common thing that people will say to me when I give them a definition of original thinking, or when I just mention original thinking. They'll often say that it may be thinking out of the box. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely part of what I'm talking about. Because when we have segmented reality, those are boxes, if you're looking at it as a physicist, or you're looking at it as a biologist, or you're looking at it as a historian, or you're looking at it from a geologic point of view, those are each particular areas of expertise, but they really aren't different in nature. I mean, you don't walk around, as my friend Phil Duran, a native physicist, a Tigua Indian, would say, there's no place in nature that announces, like, I'm geography, I'm geology, I'm physics. It's obvious that the history is in the land. You know, we may call it geology, but, you know, and it's all connected.
So, yeah, no, I'm getting where you're coming from, and I like it. It's refreshing. So what you're suggesting is that we are part of something much bigger than our individual self. There's thought that is thinking us, in a sense, and we've become so ego, self-centered, that we've forgotten our connection to this whole idea of something we're connected to, part of.
I think that's very well said, what you just said. The thought is thinking us.
Yeah.
That's true. That's more accurate. We don't have a thought. The thought has us.
But when we have to redefine who we are, then. Right? What do you mean by we or us?
Well,
or you?
I watched your interview with Deepak Chopra, and
right,
some of the same
right
thing you were talking about. I mean, there isn't a materialistic consciousness. So our material definition of we as physical bodies is a silly one, but it's also silly to just say that we're just spirit. We're both. We're spirit, we're physical, we're emotional. We're all those things.
But this bigger field that we're a part of, I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of what is this thing? This, I guess, like Rumi says, there's a field. What is this field that is, and I think if once we have the realization collectively as us being part of that something bigger, I think a lot of these ideas of separateness and individual boxes will organically start to dissolve, because we'll see the big picture. And I think we don't see that.
I certainly hope so. But look, I want to bring it down. I feel like we're getting a little too philosophical, perhaps.
Yeah, we got.
That starts to lose me after a certain point, because I don't want us to lose our audience either. Because,
no.
There's a real big danger in tacit assumptions that permeate the society, and those tacit assumptions are so strong that even in the face of new evidence, they're still held on to. So, for instance, in the early 20th century, we had the birth of quantum theory. These scientists looked inside an atom, and they found out that everything inside an atom is flux, process, and relationship. There really aren't any things inside an atom, right? But has that really permeated the society? Not yet.
No, we still have an idea, yeah.
We still believe and are very much stuck in our ideas about things, and we're still thinking about ourselves as individual selves that are separate from another person. There are a lot of creative people who are realizing that there's a field of consciousness that we're interconnected with. There's a lot of people that may not be writing about it in the way I am, but they do understand that their creativity comes from without and flows through them. People are getting it, but the mainstream society is still not getting it. So even when you have something like holistic health is extremely bereft of its full potential, because it's still trying to treat an individual as body, mind, spirit, and forgetting about how much of health is connected with our relationships and our relationships
with our environment. You mean
with other human beings, for one, but also with the earth, with water. That's what hurts my heart the most, and I tend to come back to it if you talk to me for this length of time, is water, because we are water, but what we are doing to water is really, really criminal.
Well, talk about that then. Tell us, what are we doing to water?
I'd love to talk about it. I mean, there's a great German scientist who was in the 30s, you know, Schaupauer, Victor Schaupauer, look him up.
I may be
mispronouncing his name. I know
Schallenberg, isn't it Schallen? Well, I know who you mean.
He looked at water and just very simple things, that the mechanical way that we transport water is harmful to water's spirit. He understood that water was alive, and he tried to do for water the same thing that oddly was done for air. You know, so when we designed airplanes, we have them take into account air currents, and we make subtle adjustments. We developed advanced technology around air and currents, but we do almost nothing for water. We put the water in a metal pipe, and we want to make it go straight. Well, when's the last time you saw a river that goes straight?
Right. No, I like where you're going.
So, water is meant to meander. Water heals itself through meandering. Water becomes dead when it's put in metal tubes, or it becomes dead end. I mean, it's not completely dead, but its health is affected by the way that we treat it. And the fact that we consider it inanimate, the fact that we consider it dead, mm-hmm. is the entire reason why we could even conceive about, like, drilling for oil in an ocean.
Well, just to go back to the meandering, according to the theories of Nassim Harmin, everything is spiraling like that, in that motion. Water has to, it flows as it flows on a plane. It's a two-dimension, but three dimensions are always spinning and twisting and moving in that sort of shape, or pattern. That's how I see it. So, yeah.
Well, he's a tremendous original thinker, and he's looking for the patterns in nature, and that's wonderful. That's what we need to do more and more of.
So by revitalizing water, we revitalize our bodies and also the planet, right? I mean...
Yeah. Yeah, let me tell you a story once. When I was in Costa Rica, this is when you were asking for an epiphany. I did have an epiphany when I was in Costa Rica, because I was there, I was... allegedly leading a trip to swim with dolphins and in a group. We were also going into the rainforest. It was so amazingly beautiful how much prana there was in the rivers in Costa Rica. And there I had a vision. I had a vision that I was a dolphin, and that and it's really not I, because it transcended that, but just think dolphin. Dolphin, my identity is merged with a dolphin. So dolphin dives down deep into the ocean, and just before dolphin hits the bottom of the ocean, dolphin realizes that he's a river dolphin and comes back up. And when he breaks the surface, consciousness continues up, up into the sky, and I can see the dolphin swimming there, and I saw the dolphin swimming toward the mouth of the river, and I saw all the rivers that were interconnected around it, and they became the ventricles of the human heart of Mother Earth, and I felt the beating of the drum of Mother Earth. And I was in complete ecstasy, you know, because it was just great. But, you know, I came back and I talked to he's no longer with us, but our native elder grandfather, Leon Secretary, actually he still is with us. He's kind of amazing. He's appeared to so many people after he died that he didn't even know him. But I said to Grandfather Leon Secatero, I just told him that dream, and he said to me, which I've since heard from other Native people, that this is why we have cardiovascular disease among the human population on this planet, is because we're damming up the rivers. And that the rivers of Mother Earth really are the ventricles of Mother Earth and going toward her heart, and we need to undam those rivers. So I make no apology about it. I don't like to talk in a linear or rational way about hydroelectric dams. I would like to have all of them dismantled. That would produce a lot of jobs, too.
Well, there's a ridiculous obsession with power and energy, and we need to find a better way than just taking and destroying the earth for oil. Or, I mean, there's energy all around us, but we have forgotten, you know, that we can access it. Of course, the oil companies have a hold on this, and I do believe there's some things as free energy, because look, the earth is turning. There's a lot of energy in the spinning of the earth.
Well, I agree with you. There are more creative ways, and they've been thwarted over years because they're not easy to put an economic meter on them. But there's also solar, which is a form of nuclear. It's just that the power plant is 93 million miles away. You know, so it's something that anybody who now says that solar cannot be quickly implemented in the society need look any further than Germany to see that they're actually wrong, because Germany has, you know, really in very, very short time put a huge emphasis on solar, and it's borne results.
I just want to get back to the guy you were talking about who understood the nature of water, was Victor Schauberger.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, Schauberger, right. He understood by just looking at water that water has things that it does to, in a sense, nurture its own being, if you want to call it that. And
well, my favorite person who studies water, which Schauberger studied, would be Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, he studied water.
I was blessed to inherit a book from my mother, which is actually the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. Can you imagine? Well, and it's just a great book, and he just writes at great length about water. And he just describes in very beautiful ways all the complex things that water does. And I write about that in my book because, to me, those things are life. You know, we sometimes describe them in very mechanical ways, and scientists will acknowledge these wonderful qualities of water, but even though this is a fluid, literally fluid, but also metaphorically fluid response to changing conditions, every bit, you know, exactly what we look at animals doing, and we say, oh, they're obviously alive because they're animate and they're responding to their environment and stuff. But somehow, for water, we've reduced it as a constituent of life. But it isn't. It is life. And it actually, in many, many languages, there are, you know, like Spanish, agua es la vida, there's a recognition on a deep historical level that water is life. Not water leads to life or water composes life, but water is life.
Yeah,
and
do you know William Marks?
Very important difference.
Do you know William Marks, The Holy Order of Water? He's written a beautiful book called The Holy Order of Water.
I might have it, but I'm not sure.
He's a major water activist. Of course, I've interviewed Emoto, who was a revolutionary.
I met him. Yeah, yeah. Emoto. Yes. Yeah.
So to wrap up, where does this? I mean, you've acknowledged some beautiful points. I mean, about thanking, being grateful, water. I mean, where do we go with? What would you like, you know, someone reading the book or or hearing this conversation come away with embracing and thinking.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, thank you for that opportunity. There's a lot of different things that I was taking on in the book, as you noted in the subtitle, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. Mm-hmm. And the first one was time, because I looked at the word original, and I saw how that had, what we had actually done in Western society was to replace place with time. And then because of that, we separated our consciousness from nature. And then we became proud of it. That's actually how we defined ourselves as being human. So to be human was to be the rational animal. That's what Aristotle said. But, it's a slippery slope. What we've actually continued to do is to then look at how human beings are progressing away from the actual source of our consciousness, because it really hasn't changed. Nature is still the source of our consciousness. It's only we've become to imagine that it isn't. That's very, very dangerous. So the first thing I want to do is for people to just imagine that again, to actually have the experience of that. And they can do that in so many ways.
When you say that, what do you mean by that again?
To understand that their consciousness comes from nature. So the biggest definition of original thinking is think of the origin of thinking. Where's thought coming from? And it's coming from the same place that spirit's coming from. It's coming from the place of your gut instincts, your emotions, your feelings. All of those things serve to connect you to nature instead of separating. And it's still very possible, I'm not a pessimist, it's still very possible for us to recover that way of thinking without losing the benefit of what we tend to, linear, rational, analytic thinking. I'm not suggesting that we do away with that. I'm just suggesting that we recover the source of our consciousness so that we start from a more wise place. And then we model our technology after nature so that what we're doing actually enhances the way that we're interconnected with the world instead of separating ourselves from the world. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only way we're going to save ourselves, Alan, in my view, because otherwise we're going on not just an unsustainable path, but it's worse than that.
It's a destructive path. Yeah, it's not just unsustainable. It's an accelerated destruction.
Right. I don't like the word sustainability anyway. Mm-hmm. I would like words like revitalization, mm-hmm. remembrance. Pretty much every reword in the English language I like. So
But. Do you ever feel, and I don't know you personally, but I mean, do you feel like you have to live in this culture that is so disposable? Do you feel hypocritical, I guess I'm asking you, because maybe you're living like Thoreau at Walden, but do you ever feel like you're not, like you're going along with this, thing that's been created? I mean, how do you live with that awareness and be in the world, I guess, in the society that as it functions today?
I think you can do both. My biggest passion is about reforming thinking and reforming education, beginning from holes. But that doesn't have anything to do with rejecting what is. It just has to do with embracing what is in tune with nature. So, for instance, I drive the latest hybrid car because I think it's ecological. I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, I use computers because computers are tremendous tools, but I don't want to forget that my own mind has the capability of accessing directly from nature inspiration. I don't want to just like think that everything in the world has to be learned through typing something in on Google.
Right. No, I mean, it's just curious. I mean, just that we want these ideals, and yet we're living in a world where, you know, it's sort of a stopping a snowball that's going downhill. I mean, but I guess it can be stopped, and in a way, it must be.
Well, we all do what we're called to do. What I'm called to do, well, let me rephrase it, actually. A lot of people are called to do things. Some people leave that call on the answering machine, you know. I mean, I shouldn't really say that everybody does what they're called to do, but I think everybody has a calling. Mm. And for me, it's about getting to the root of thought, and I'm just trying to hold that up. What I'm trying to do with an organization that I'm in the process of founding right now, called the Circle for Original Thinking. That's a grassroots think tank. And the purpose of that organization is to bring wisdom into contemporary decision making. Because what is wisdom? It's timeless.
I think all the things you're talking about need to be heard. We definitely need to reformat our education. We need to have think tanks. We'll wrap up, but I'm just curious, did anything come out of those think tanks that you were involved in with the physicists and the Native Americans? What was the outcome of those?
Enormous amount of things came from it. I give full credit to a lot of what has inspired me came out of the creative construction of knowledge in a dialogue circle. I mean, that's where I physically learned the thought was moving, alive, and in the room. Mm. Alan, there was a guy, his name is Joseph Rael, maybe you've heard of him, or Beautiful Painted Arrow, a picture.
I met Beautiful Painted Arrow. Is he still around?
Yes. And he was one of the people who was in the dialogue circle. For Joseph, he actually saw and would describe these beautiful energy forms that were flowing through the room and stuff. I don't see like he sees, but I feel and I sense that energy moving. I saw that some people would open their mouth and say exactly what was crossing my mind at that time. And I learned that thought was alive and was co-constructed. It was very creative. So all of this is very important to recover what has been called participatory consciousness, to recover it consciously, to not just think of it as some anomaly, just to remember that's the way it really is. And it's a community-oriented way of thinking. It's a beautiful thing. And I think it's happening. I think, you know, people are, you know, even in politics, people think it's a, you know, I think there's some revival of town halls or something. This is a very primitive form of participatory consciousness, but it's better than just somebody standing up there and talking at an audience.
Well, it would be great to have that talking about education in classrooms. Is that possible, you think?
How much time do we have?
Well, as much as we want, really, because if you have something to say about that, I think it would be important.
Education, I've been drawn to reforming graduate education because there's already tremendous things happening in elementary education. More than any other area of thought, I think we need to look toward the Waldorf schools and the Montessori schools and take that model and bring it up into as high as the graduate level. Now, this is considered a radical idea, but what do the Waldorf schools do that really is super necessary? They didn't rush rational thought in children. They allow them to play in nature. They allow the creative forces of nature to come through them. And later on, when they develop rational thought or abstract conceptual thought, it's still grounded in the natural world. We actually need to kind of do that again as adults, you know, and have a renaissance of remembering how it is to be a child. You know, this is another thing I might have learned from Bucky Fuller. I mean, he was once asked, you know, how he was different. And he said he doesn't have any special talent more than children. The only difference was he didn't allow that childlike innocence to be programmed out of himself. You know, so we really need to recover that in our higher levels of education. And then we'll begin to understand in a very sensual and experiential way how everything is interconnected. So obviously we should take our classes outdoors instead of learning about biology only from textbooks or doing horrible things to frogs, you know, in front of you or something. You know, why don't you observe frogs in the water?
No, I
mean, this is pretty simple stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's been the fault of our culture, is to fragment and separate ourselves. And one thing I just wanted to add, because we did talk about the Aborigines, you know what kept them intact, their culture, is that they never developed an agriculture. They never owned land. They never progressed in that linear understanding of this is mine, that's yours. It was from what I know of them, it was a very collective, open awareness of being hunters and gatherers, and they never divided the land or owned each other, that which created the whole linear separation in societies. And so I just thought that was interesting that they stayed pure.
Well, the same thing would be true of Native Americans, this is very complicated stuff, but you know, one of the amazing things I learned from the Blackfoot people and from Leroy Little Bear in particular, is in his native Blackfoot language, there would really be no word for I. You know, there's actually no separation between humans and their environment. I mean, they're completely immersed in it. So for Native people, they may say sentences in English that sound strange, like, I am the land, I am the water, you know. But it's not strange. It's actually more of an accurate communication. But, you know, what's kind of sad about it is sometimes that gets kind of communicated in this way on greeting cards and stuff, and it sounds very fanciful and poetic, but what people are missing is the actual value of thinking that way. Now, but I want to go back to something that you said before. Yeah. I don't want to overemphasize, I don't want to say that there's no benefit to abstract thinking, you know, or dividing things into parts. I think sometimes it is necessary to take a complex whole and divide it into parts. I'm just suggesting that we remember what the whole is.
Right. I mean, I think we can have both. I mean, I think
both end.
We need to remember the original thinking and to acknowledge that, you know, we're evolving into something. Something's moving through us, as we said, and we're also connected to where we've come from. So
yes, we recycle things so much more than we realize. So remember, you talked about the Middle Ages before?
Yes.
Well, 5 years ago, I saw a newspaper in the Albuquerque area which proclaimed new hospitals with fresh air and sunlight. Mm-hmm. Well, when do you think we had that before?
The
Middle Ages. They were called sanatoriums, so they had fresh air, sunlight, they had grounds, because they believed that people were holy, or in a whole, which meant to be whole, to be healed, you needed to go out in the fresh air, the sunlight. It's it really should be common sense. Mm-hmm. But instead, because we were part of the culture that fragmented, that segregated, that tried to control and predict, and we created hospitals where people were put in little boxes, and they were they underwent technological procedures which were highly advanced, but their soul was stripped away.
Yeah, and the food is awful too.
And the food is awful, right? I mean, you got to have good food.
Of course. No, I like everything you're saying here, and we have to keep going toward. I mean, we have to keep, pushing towards what we know is right and true.
So to sum up, I mean,
yes.
What I'm looking for is a wider and wiser approach to thinking, a wider and wiser approach to decision making, which includes and looks at the whole breadth of human endeavor and allows it all that to come forward now, instead of just being, little blind people who are just following the latest trend, having a blind faith that's going to be better.
Yeah, no, it's
awful. We need to look at it all.
We need to look at it all, and we need to return to original thinking now that I understand the concept and realize that what we're calling thinking is much bigger than the intellect, what you're calling thinking. The actual motion of creation moving through us.
Yes, and to bring it back from where we started, remember that thinking is thanking in all our thoughts and deeds. And that's to begin from blessing is just a beautiful thing. And I learned that from indigenous people who of all peoples could have been the most bitter, because look what happened to their societies in the last 500 years. But it's the indigenous peoples that were the ones that taught me to look at life as a blessing.
And are we thanking the Great Spirit, the mystery of all things? I mean, what would you say the thank is to?
Yeah, I mean, the thanking, whether it's to, the words don't matter, whether it's creator, Great Spirit, that's of no importance to me, really, but it's being, the most powerful definition of creator for me is more the elements, light, air, water, earth, because that actually is what creates all of life. It is life in and of themselves. That's a prayer I say every morning. That I thank the elements, light, air, water, earth, and I pray that they be understood as kin, as living, and given the reverence that they deserve.
Mm. Thank you, Glenn, for the time you've put into this conversation. Of course, the time you put into the book and your dedication to the truth. I mean, your dedication to bringing these ideas out to help change the way we've been living so we could be at more peace and harmony and love and gratefulness.
Oh, I'm glad that you said that. Thank you very much. It was very well said.
Well, I think
you.
Well, I think you're trying to do what you are doing is, bringing people back to who they really are.
That's what I'm seeking to do, and if I'm doing it and that's what you felt, then that makes me happy. Thank you for the blessing of being on the show. Thank you for the blessing of the work that you do, and may you be blessed.
Mm.
May your guests be blessed. May your audience be blessed. Thank you.
Thank you. Your website is originalthinking.us?
Correct, originalthinking.us.
And you are Glenn Aparicio Parry.
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to be on a speaking tour anywhere? Are you going to be?
I will be once the book is coming out April 14th. My wonderful publicist Jill Mangino will be I guess I just made, I'm publicizing my publicist now.
But that's okay.
because she is wonderful. And
she's an old friend. I've known her for 25 years or more. Yeah,
well, she's got a beautiful heart. And I appreciate being seen by her and the work that she's doing in the world. And I appreciate the work that you are doing in the world, Alan. And I understand you're old friends with my good friend Carol Hart, too. So.
Yes, Carol Hart, who did a beautiful film on the 13 Grandmothers.
That's how I met her.
You met her at that. Because I was hanging out with her in Albuquerque about 2 years ago at the Albuquerque Film and Media Experience.
I was there.
Oh, you were there? I ran a couple of. I ran the UFO panel. If you came to that, the Flying Star Cafe, and then.
No, I didn't come to that, but you know, I put on a UFO conference once. So
you did? Where? Because I'm totally into a lot of my programs about UFOs. And, where was your UFO conference?
Alcalde, New Mexico, of all places, with. I was running a gallery and cafe when I first moved to New Mexico in 1994, and people used to come up to me and tell us the stories about things they had seen.
Ojo Caliente, did you say?
No, Alcalde, but it was not
Alcalde.
More than 20 minutes from Ojo Caliente.
Alcalde, I don't know.
Alcalde
that.
Is a little town. You wouldn't necessarily know it, but it's between Santa Fe and Taos.
Oh, it is? Because I used to travel that road between Santa Fe and Taos, and I guess I wish I would have known your cafe was there.
Between 1994 and 1996, were you there then?
I was in and out of there, yeah. I was still living part-time in Santa Fe.
You could have come into the cafe already. We may have already met. You know,
we have, maybe with Carol in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Anyway, Carol is a great person, a very kind person, and her movie is amazing.
It is amazing. Well, she's done so many things in her life. But
yeah,
thank you very
really.
Much for the opportunity to speak, and I wish you all the blessings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'll be in touch. This program you can find you'll find it on iTunes, also BBS Radio, also on my website, newrealities.com. So, thank you, Glenn. I've been talking to Glenn Aparicio Parry. His new book is Original Thinking, coming out this April. And I think it's a great topic that we need to remember or know about. It's the subtitles are Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. So another New Realities recommendation. Thanks for listening tonight. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and if you want to reach me, you can go to my website, newrealities.com, or you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. Good night.